All right, well, we gather on Treaty 1, the original lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation, and we gather with gratitude for shared land and shared home. Welcome to today's talky bit. I think it might be spring, but just barely. I am seriously starting to wonder if the mountain biking trails in Birds Hill Park this year are going to be like the mountain bike trails in the Rockies, where the snow is still like 3 feet deep in the shady spots in July. You know, you just ride around the corner of what you thought was summer, and all of a sudden your axles deep in winter. My belief in spring is starting to feel like an act of faith of, you know, religious proportions. At this point, it feels like. But when I was a kid, sort of late elementary, early junior high kind of age, there was one sure sign of spring where I grew up. And you could count on this. Didn't matter how deep the snow was piled up. This was the one. You could tell it was spring when the kids started to play marbles at recess. That meant it was spring. Incontrovertible. I've not been under the impression that marbles have made any sort of comeback, sort of not like skateboarding for a second, third wave feminism, nothing like that kind of happening with marbles. If I'm wrong about that, someone let me know, but let me know later, because right now I'm trying to make a point. Okay, so just, but I'm not aware that that's happened. Anyway, when I was a kid, I knew that it was spring when the marbles came out. And of course, the main reason that we got out our marbles was so that we could play marbles. So there's marbles, and then there's the thing, and then there's marbles, the game, right? We got out the marbles so we could play marbles. And it's sort of like naming your cat Kitty. no big leaps of naming imagination going on here. And the basic game, for those of you that didn't grow up with this, was, at least where I was, I mean, this might be a hyper-local game, but the rules of the game where I grew up was that you drew a circle in whatever the surface was you were playing on, so the dirt or the snow or the slush. Or I was thinking about this morning. I was like, if we were playing marbles right now, kids would be like bringing their spray paint cans or something. So you just spray a circle on the ice. You can't actually carve a circle in there. But so you'd make a circle, and then you would put whatever marbles were at stake in the game inside the circle. And then in a game that had a bewildering and constantly evolving set of rules, you would try to shoot your opponent's marbles out of the circle with your shooter. So that's basically the game. So maybe if that's not a familiar game, maybe like imagine golf, but your goal isn't to hit the cup. Your goal is to knock the other person's ball into the rough. Or something like that. Kind of like golf meets curling meets croquet. I don't know. Like it kind of, yeah, something like that. So in any case, to keep the game interesting, sometimes what happened is that the stakes got raised. And it was kind of just understood that in the schoolyard, you had to lay out the ground rules before anyone committed to playing. It was bad form, not fair play if you sucker someone into a game and then you change the stakes. That's not okay. So what moved the game from casual to basically blood sport was whether it was keepers or not. Okay? So in a casual game, if you successfully knocked your opponent's marbles out of the circle, they went back to their original owner. In keepers, if you knocked them out of the circle, you got to keep them. They changed hands. They changed owners. And then, to sort of up the ante a bit more, not all kinds of marbles had the same value. And this is where it got kind of complicated. There were clear marbles. There were solid marbles. There were solid marbles that were shot through with color. Marbles came in lots of different sizes in all those variations, and they all had different relative values. So when I think back on it now, it was pretty much an entire monetary system. Like, marbles were the currency. But it was about as arbitrary as our monetary system, where there's different pieces of paper representing different values. Not everyone agreed about all the details, and sometimes those differences got pretty heated. Sometimes they even came to blows. My first memorable experiences of violence as a means of gaining wealth happened around marbles. That's where I started to learn how that worked. And sometimes it got so out of control that the authorities had to step in. And if it got really wild, then the parents even got involved. So as you might imagine, not all the marble ownership changes happened as a result of gameplay. Because marbles had value outside of the game, right? So there was this always this lively trading exchange kind of going on. Kind of like, I'll give you two clear spirals for one solid state. All of this bargaining. And even if you had a really coveted marble, sometimes there'd be this pretty wild speculative maneuvers along the lines of, I'll give you everything in my marble bag for that one solid state swirl. That kind of stuff. I was never a big enough player to know if there were like angel investors or the junior version of like venture capitalists doing business out behind the gym. Like that was big kid stuff. You could get beat up if a deal went bad out behind the gym. So I just kind of never went there. But when I stand back from all of that a bit, as I did this past week, I realized that although my memories of this are unique to me, there's nothing all that new about what's going on there systemically. And I think that's true both in a material way that sort of has to do with doing business, so to speak, but also in deeper ways that have to do with how we sort out what we value or what we believe, that there's a linkage between those experiences and those things. You might not know this, but Jesus told a parable about marbles. Skeptics, let me make my case. It's found in Matthew 13, 45 and 46, and the text says this. The kingdom of heaven is like a man, a merchant, seeking fine pearls. And yes, there were marbles known as pearls. Or on finding one pearl of extremely great value, who went and sold all that he had and bought it. There. Right? I think my case stands. Now, I want to say before I can get into how this parable is actually about marbles, I think that what we're about to do can be one of the most challenging tasks when it comes to exploring what we believe. What I mean by that is that to do a good job, or if you prefer, an effective job of exploring what we believe, it's essential to stay curious and open. Without that aspect of our exploring being in relatively good repair, we're more likely to be rearranging what we already know than we are to be what I would call exploring. We're treading familiar ground, not new ground. Now, when it comes to what we believe, familiar ground is also important. It can play an essential role in grounding us, in stabilizing us, and helping us navigate the world, especially when the world is a place of rapid change or deeply felt uncertainty, and haven't we been there, recently? I am not denigrating that, but I am distinguishing it from exploring, which by definition takes us away from what we already know and into what we don't. And what makes exploring what we believe through the vehicle of something like this parable so challenging for some of us is that we've heard this text or others like it explained, preached, applied so many times that it's extremely difficult to experience it as anything other than familiar ground. And for some of us, that might not only not be desirable, but it might even be pretty much impossible to pull off, even if we want to. And if that's where you're at, if this is not desirable, then this might not be for you. I mean, you decide, of course. But my hope is that you'll hang in there, because the perspective that I'm going to take on this parable was new to me when I came across it in my own explorations. And I would think it's fair to say I've heard this text taken apart pretty much ad nauseum. I should also give credit where it's due. The primary vantage point that I'm working with on this text comes from Amy Jill Levine, who self-describes as, quote, a Yankee/Jewish feminist who teaches in a predominantly Christian divinity school in the buckle of the Bible Belt. For those who might benefit from some cross-border translating, what that means is that geographically and occupationally is that Levin is she's a professor of several different disciplines, but she's also the editor of the Annotated Jewish New Testament. There's a document I don't have on my bookshelf, but sounds fascinating. So she's a prof of a bunch of different disciplines. She teaches at Vanderbilt Divinity School and College of Arts and Science in Nashville, Tennessee. So fair to describe that as the buckle of the Bible Belt, I think. As you might be able to imagine, that kind of a pedigree sometimes means that the author is quite a bit more attached to religious structures than I am, but I also have a great deal of respect for Levine's scholarship, which I experience as, I would use words like deep and rigorous and unflinching about it. This is a person who does not seem to be afraid to swim upstream alone, and I appreciate that. So back to marbles. In the case of the parable, the marble in question is called a pearl. And the central character in the story likes pearls. They like them a lot. And they like to trade them, preferably in a profitable manner. They like this enough that they have made it their business. Now, if you have heard this parable explained or applied before, the odds are pretty good that you've heard it dealt with as an allegory. And if you want the full breakdown of why that really doesn't work, as Levine explains it at length, I can tell you where to find it. But I'm going to shorten it to this. The problem with using this as an allegory is that allegories require a key. The audience needs to know what is associated with what in order to take meaning from an allegory. Most of the allegorical interpretations of this parable wouldn't have worked for the people Jesus was talking to because they rely on keys those people wouldn't have had. Ideas like this being a parable about discipleship, with the focus being on the person who chooses to seek the kingdom of heaven. In that version, the merchant is a radical because he's sacrificing everything he has to gain the kingdom. You know, go and do likewise. End of sermon. So in simple terms, under that kind of an approach to this text, we have two problems. One is that most Christian ideas about what constitutes the kingdom didn't exist when Jesus told this story. There were no such thing as Christians at this point in history. No one is seeking Jesus unless it's to try to figure out what he's on about when he tells stories like this. So that key isn't present to the audience for the story. Wouldn't have worked. The second problem is that the story form itself is a parable. And parables, by definition, exist to challenge and surprise. And that reading, and others akin to it, don't do that. They just reiterate and reinforce traditional Christian doctrines and perspectives. Now, it's not that those readings can't be gleaned from this source. Of course they can. They might even speak to timeless truths, they might speak to ultimate longings, but they don't necessarily serve either the parable or the explorer well. And in those regards, I think we can do better. And I think that the place we start is by taking the parable as we have it, as at its word or at its words. So, stop one. The protagonist in this parable is not, first of all, a merchant. They are, first of all, a person, a human. There was a man, which, by the way, means human. So this is not a gendered story, except secondarily. There was a man. Now, this matters to our exploration because it opens the story up to all of us, and it also makes the story about identity and how our identities can change based on our choices. It sets that up by establishing the baseline of the protagonist is that they are a human. Nobody's left out of that. The human in this story, at the beginning of the story, has a secondary identity, a subsequent identity, as a merchant. You dive into this one in the literature, and it gets messy. But generally speaking, in the context that Jesus is talking, merchants are not highly regarded. And there's lots of evidence to substantiate that. So to say the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant is already curious, and it's not an especially positive association. It would probably have had the audience going, what? Which is exactly what a parable is supposed to do, should surprise and challenge, and kind of doing the, if the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant, if that's what Jesus is selling, I don't think I'm buying. So right out of the gate, you're just kind of on tilt. Which brings us to the marbles, or if you insist, the pearls. In most allegorical interpretations of this parable, the pearl is the most desirable thing one could have, and so it must symbolize the Christ or the gospel or the kingdom. But that's not what the parable says. The kingdom of heaven in the parable is not compared to the pearl. It's compared to the human, who is also a merchant, who in the process of seeking fine pearls sells all that he has for one fabulous item. But that's not even what he was looking for. He was looking for, according to the parable, fine pearls. He was looking for a product that he can use to his own ends. He's a merchant. If we want to make an analogy at this point, we might see in him someone who is seeking primarily a project of self-interest. Perhaps on a good day, we could characterize it as a project of self-improvement, but he's not looking for the one big thing. He's looking for fine pearls, plural. And he's looking for them as a merchant. This, Jesus says, is what the kingdom of heaven is like. And when he comes across this extraordinary pearl, it knocks him off track. It redirects him. He sells what he has, he buys it. In other words, he goes out of business. He ceases to be a merchant. He changes his identity. He would now be known quite reasonably as, you know, the guy who used to be a merchant but is now the person who owns the pearl of great price, or whatever fanciful name we gave to that singular pearl. The kicker here is that in the process of exploring his own interests and improvement, he came across something he wasn't even looking for, and it changed his life to such a degree that it redefined him. He was willing to trade his whole bag of marbles for that one pearl of great price. Is it reasonable, do you think, to suggest that we all have a pearl of great price? Do we all have something we would give everything for, something we would be okay being defined by, something we would be willing to go from merchant to owner of the pearl for? I was facilitating a workshop recently with a group of Indigenous leaders. I know that might sound a bit out of whack, but it was at their request. I protested. They insisted I did it. It was great, great, great fun. But at one point in that workshop, we did an exercise together that included people addressing themselves to the question, if you knew you could not fail, what would you want to do? And one of the participants was really struggling. It was like she just couldn't allow herself to go there. It was just too far a reach somehow. And the group was very encouraging, very supportive. It was really beautiful. Eventually she came out with, if I could do anything and I knew I couldn't fail, I would become fluent in Cree. And she was already taking an online course in Cree, but she was concerned that she wouldn't get it right, you know? And that felt like a big deal. I would become fluent in Cree. And so the group, again, just continued in sort of that beautiful spirit. Everyone was very affirming, and we carried on. And then just as we were... You had to be there. Just as we were moving on to the next person, she blurted out, and NASCAR. It's like stock car racing. And it was like, screech! You know, everybody was doing, what the? Everybody's just sort of having this moment. She's like, yeah, I'd be a NASCAR driver. I don't know what your stereotype of a NASCAR driver is as regards appearance and so on. Personality, maybe, whatever. I didn't even know I had stereotypes until she said NASCAR. And I was looking at her and I was thinking, no. it was so great. And then so, of course, everybody just kind of is reacting to this. And then one of the older women in the group responded to this whole exchange with a phrase in Cree, and then everybody in the room except me cracked up. And so then I had to know what the phrase was, right? Turns out it's kind of this Cree idiom that would roughly translate as, I'm going fast, get out of my way. And we all agreed by the end of the exchange that that's what should be painted on the front bumper of her stock car, like in Cree. Because then if she's pulling up behind somebody, they're going to be so busy trying to read what's on her bumper, they'll lose track, they'll hit the wall, she'll go by, she'll win. So we kind of had the whole story by the end. It was great. I felt like she had done a very brave thing. I felt like she had pried open the door and given us a glimpse of what might be worth, you know, all the marbles for her, what her pearl of great price might be about. Not even so much in the specifics as in the bigger themes. What if when we're looking at a bunch of people that are seeking fine pearls, that are seeking the things of great value in life, we're basically looking at what Jesus called the kingdom of heaven? The kingdom of heaven is like a man, a merchant, who's looking for fine pearls. Period. The next part, right? What happens next? That follows on that first part. What if What if, in the course of that search, which is like the kingdom of heaven, there's a chance that we might stumble across something that just grabs hold of us and won't let go, something that we realize we're not just okay with having define us, but that we would give all that we have to possess and to never lose again? From where I sit, even that possibility sounds like a sufficient reason to keep exploring what we believe. Because exploring what we believe, in the context of this parable, constitutes the kingdom of heaven. Pick it up, put it down, carry it for a while, see how it feels. You know, one of the beauties of parables is that when we come to them with different eyes, different questions, they give us a different point of view. They give us different answers. They challenge and they surprise.